They say that hindsight is 20/20. Well, in 2021, we will be retroactively applying our modern perspective to films and TV shows celebrating their 20th anniversary. This is a Binge Movies retrospective of A Knight's Tale. On this retrospective, my guest is Catherine Gonzalez, film and TV critic from Shuffle Online. She's a taco aficionado. She's a co-host of Shuffle the Pod and Latinx Lens. You've heard her on previous episodes of Binge Movies. It's always a good time talking to her. So check out the conversation about 2001's A Knight's Tale.
Enough, a man can do anything.
We could do this. In 1 month, we could be on our way to glory and riches none of us ever dreamed of.
You can't even joust.
I think he's getting worse.
He is getting worse.
And I won't spend the rest of my life as nothing.
You have to be of noble birth to compete.
So we lie.
My lords, my ladies. The privilege, nay, the pleasure of introducing to you a knight, sired by knights.
William Thatcher didn't make the rules. He was born.
I've waited my whole life for this moment.
To break them.
Yes! Thank you, I'll be here all week.
Well, that was different.
And you are? Ulrich von Lichtenstein from Gelderland.
Sir Ulrich von Lichtenstein. I would have him win my heart.
He's won 4 tournaments in a row.
On a horse, that man is unbeatable.
You're just a silly boy with a horse and a stick.
It's called a lass. Hello?
If the nobles find out who you are, there'll be the devil to pay.
And pray that they don't.
Ulrich von Lichtenstein is not who he appears to be.
They're going to arrest you. 12 royal guards.
I love you. There's nothing else to do. Run, and I will run with you.
I will not run!
I'm a knight. I'm here to compete. Let's dance, you and I.
So long as I can call you my own.
How have you been since the days of Air Force One?
Yeah, a lot has happened since then. I got my house, first house. So moved into that. Got COVID as well over the new year. Yay.
Oh, no.
That was not fun. But then everything's is going well. I can't complain besides those unfortunate events. But living in my house. And also, I just got a puppy, Rex, who's driving us a little crazy. But we also love him so much already. So it's been good.
I've been seeing the tweets. So
yeah, right. I'm like, I'm that annoying person that's posting photos of their like dog or kid, and I'm like, oh, I hate myself, but he's so cute, so I'm gonna post it anyway.
Yeah, you have to. Well, you're like you're the first up for this, so this is kind of an experiment because I looked at the calendar and it's 2001. You know, it's 20 years ago now. Which is sort of mind-boggling to me. That's really the sort of maybe the first time in my life where I really started to feel old. I started to realize that some of the people I may be interacting with on social media, on Twitter, were born after the year 2001.
Yeah. I've been coming to that conclusion as well, and it's a little unnerving.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly right. It's deeply unnerving. So I thought, let's just drill down in corporate speak on that unnerving feeling and make everybody uncomfortable by recognizing the fact that it was 20 years ago. So all throughout 2021, we'll be dropping bonus retrospectives on TV and film that came out in 2001, something that's celebrating its 20th anniversary. Some of these things are going to be things that were relatively successful or beloved at the time. Some of them are going to be things that maybe have gained a cult following since. Some of them are going to be things that maybe we all liked at the time. But the point is, we have the power of hindsight. We have the power of, you know, pun semi-intended, we have the power of retrospective. We don't just have our perspective in the moment, in the present. We can actually look back to the past and see if these things are as charming or as entertaining or as intelligent or as, quite frankly, good as we remember them being. We're kicking it off with maybe one of the most mild hits. I don't even know if you really want to call it a hit. Yeah. One of the most mildly enjoyed movies of all time. And so we're going to have a free-flowing conversation about 2001's A Knight's Tale, starring the late Heath Ledger. What is your history with A Knight's Tale? And were you a fan of this in 2001 or shortly thereafter? Or is this the first time you've ever seen it? Where are you at with this movie?
Yeah, no, I think I saw it. I don't know if I saw it in 2001 because I wouldn't really go to the movies until like 2004 when I was in high school because, you know, I don't know, my parents or whatever. So I would watch, you know, so I probably watched it delayed. So I don't know if it was when I got into my movie phase in high school, but I feel like it was around that time period. I'm just going to do a loose like 5 to 6 years of that, for, like maybe 2005 or something. Mm-hmm. But I remember watching it and actually I loosely remember watching it. It's not something that I've watched over the years a lot, but I always kind of, like you said, I think you put it like you said it really well, where you're like, it's like the mildly enjoyed hit. Cause I don't think about it and say like, oh, I hate that movie or like, oh, I really love it. It was kind of just in the middle for me. And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, that's kind of weird. They have like the new modern songs and in this movie, cause I love period pieces, or I was starting to love period pieces. And so I think I was just kind of lukewarm on it. Like I didn't love or hate it. I love Heath Ledger. And I loved, you know, some of these other characters, like the Paul Bettany character and all that. But then I have to say it benefited from this retrospective of watching it recently for this podcast. And I'm excited to talk about it because I think 20 years later, I mean, if I was like 15 or something when I watched it, I'm able to appreciate it now a lot more, especially some of the filmmaking choices that I probably would not have picked up upon, you know, when I was watching it when I was younger. So I'm excited. Yeah.
I feel like this had a really strong run on TNT.
Yeah.
For a while, didn't it? Like it seemed like it was, I don't know what time frame that was, but it seemed like it had a good, like at least 5 year run where every weekend it was A Knight's Tale. And I think it probably had something to do with, you know, once he passed, but with The Dark Knight coming out, I think this was like, you know how when a star makes a movie and they're not really a star, they're on the rise, and then they make a huge movie, mm-hmm. all of a sudden all of their lesser, earlier works are on heavy rotation, you know? I think that's what this was, where it came out, and this was a follow-up to, was he in 10 Things I Hate About You or Can't Hardly Wait? Which one was he in?
10 Things I Hate About You, which I love. Yeah, and that was, I think, 99, if don't quote me, but I think that's what it was.
Right.
Or, so then he does, or like another 2001, yeah.
Yeah, then he does like The Patriot in 2000, and then he does this in 2001. And so he had like this good little run. This is really sort of the first movie where he is the lead, right? They're definitely mm-hmm. positioning him as the main guy. It's not him and Mel Gibson. It's not him and an ensemble of teens. This is really his movie, and he has to kind of carry it. It's still an ensemble piece, but a lot of it's on him. He is the main character. And we'll get into that in a second, because there's some very odd choices that were made in this movie yes. that I didn't understand structurally. But they marketed it in a very odd way, where I wasn't really sure if the marketing was just adding anachronistic music, which is not uncommon, mm-hmm. or if the anachronistic music was in the movie. I remember the marketing for it sort of marketing it as like a Baz Luhrmann like style movie, where it's going to be this sort of wacky, kind of over the top, broad, like, you know, what's the Baz Luhrmann one that he put out right around this time?
Is Moulin Rouge? No,
Moulin Rouge. Right.
Moulin Rouge. Yeah.
It was going to be like a tamed Moulin Rouge, right? And then
I eventually saw it, and it's not really what this is. And no. It's really hard to put your finger on what this is, because it's not like swinging for the fences. You think, okay, it's a period piece, like you said. Is it an adaptation of The Knight's Tale, Geoffrey Chaucer? Not really.
Yeah.
Is it historical fiction, like Shakespeare in Love? No. Not really. Is it a broad, weird, like alternative reality musical thing, like Baz Luhrmann, like Romeo and Juliet, or Romeo plus Juliet, I apologize, or Moulin Rouge? Not really. So it's like,
yeah.
What is this? So I eventually saw it on cable about halfway through, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I saw it was coming up for its 20th anniversary. I rewatched it for this pod and for this episode. And now I have to ask you the question. What is A Knight's Tale? What is this movie? What is the genre? What is the tone you think they were going for?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I actually, this is probably one where I don't really know what it is. But maybe after watching it, I would say period piece with like some, I don't know, it's very heartfelt. So period piece mixed in comedic modern, because, you know, I don't know if you felt this way, and maybe this can help answer this question, which I'm not answering very well. So sorry, guys. I can speak complete sentences, I promise. But I think it felt very modern in a way. And so like it felt like it could have been made in 2021, except with like a few like the story wise, right? Like it felt like mm-hmm. the women, like the female characters in this are very like modern. I was like, whoa, this was like 2001. Like we're barely getting these sort of storylines, you know, with some of what they did in that film. So I was like, so I don't know if, I don't want to say timeless, because it's not like a timeless tale. Like, well, I guess it sort of is, but I think they just kind of went for maybe more of going around his character William Thatcher, and maybe just trying to set it in this time, and then I don't know, put some comedic flair on it, and because I will say I'm a sucker for these kind of like storylines, even if it's like really dumb movies, I still will cry in those heartfelt moments where you're supposed to cry. So like and then my husband had walked in like halfway through, and there was like that one of the heartfelt moments, he's like, are you crying? And I was like, shut up. So I keep going back to like, it's just like a nice movie. And I really don't know, now that you're like highlighting it, like what kind of period, it's not really a period piece either. No. Cause it's not like the period pieces that I love, you know, where it's like, they're really going for like the history of it. Like, you know, they wear kind of like a bit of a modern dress, but just to like in the fabrics that you think are from this time period. And even, Shannon Sossaman's character, like a Jocelyn, like she's kind of wearing like, I don't know, it feels like it's like Audrey Hepburn, like hats and stuff, you know? So,
yeah,
to answer your question that I did not answer, I don't know.
I think that gets to the part of the reason why I don't think it necessarily found an audience, because how do you market it? You can't market it as like farce, as fantasy,
yeah,
as high fantasy, because it's not really what it is. You can't really market it as an action movie, because the one thing I'll say about it is, I don't know if there's ever been a more boring sport ever put to film than jousting. I mean, I don't want to knock the movie, but jousting is pretty boring, and all of the jousting scenes are indistinguishable. I don't, you know, William's on one side, some vague count of Monte Cristo's on the other side, Baron von Fleckenstein is on the other side, and you know, he may or may not be the King of Wales. We don't know. But, you know, he's somebody else is there. And it's just the same thing. We're watching splinters and people fall off horses over and over and over again. And they say that they're moving countries, but every single set piece looks like it was shot at the exact same place. And I do have a question, which is, well, I have a lot of structural problems with this movie. I went into it thinking, okay, this is going to be a nice, fun one to revisit, because it is sort of this anomaly movie. It's hard to put your thumb on what it is, and it's got Heath Ledger, you know, kind of on the rise. It's going to be a really, you know, Paul Bettany. It's got a lot of people who've gone on to do, mm-hmm. you know, you've got Mark Addy, who, you know, went on to do Game of Thrones. He was Robert Baratheon for A Cup of Coffee.
Yeah.
You know,
Rufus.
Yeah. And Fred Flintstone in Viva Rock Vegas. And he was in The Full Monty, which we've covered on the show, in our main show. And then, you know, you've got Paul Bettany, obviously, who ends up being, you know, Jarvis, and then Vision, and then obviously Heath Ledger goes on to be Joker, and you know, you have Alan Tudyk, and you have all of these people. Shannon Sossaman, who was poised to be kind of the next Hollywood it girl, makes a handful of movies and disappeared off the scene.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you have a lot of young and older talent that have done a lot of things, right? Rufus Sewell, who's, you know, the consummate asshole in everything he's ever been.
Yes, in. Yeah. I know. Justice for Rufus, because I like him. But he's always like, he's like the hot, very handsome, but obviously always like cast as this like villain. I'm like, why?
Always.
Oh, and sometimes it's not even his fault. Like, he was in the Tristan and Isolde movie too, and it was just like, you know, he ends up being the villain just because this girl loves someone else. I don't know. It's just
right. And the thing I've wondered about him, you know, we've covered him a few times in the show, our main show, is I'm sort of surprised he has yet to turn up in a Marvel movie as a villain.
Yeah.
He seems very much like he could be like, you know, some, like, put him in some ridiculous blue makeup. Maybe he doesn't want to be in makeup, but he definitely seems like. I don't know. If I had to pick between Jude Law and Rufus Sewell and in Captain Marvel, I think I'd pick Rufus. Like, I hate to say that, right? I hate to say, hey, you know, anyone who hasn't already been cast in a superhero movie from this movie ought to be in a superhero movie, because like, there are other movies in the world. But in 2021, I think I'm just surprised, I'm saying, that like one of the greatest British assholes of all time has yet to show. Like, wouldn't he be a great foil to a Benedict Cumberbatch in a Doctor Strange movie? Wouldn't he be a great villain? You know, I don't know. I just think it's
a missed opportunity. I think we're casting the next Marvel or DCEU. Yeah, and he's such a good actor too. You know, he really sells these, and I think that's why I like in this movie, all of these. It feels like they're all way better than that this movie kind of deserves, you know, because it's kind of just like I don't know what those stories are, which I think also seeing this movie from 2001 made me kind of miss these movies as well. Because I think in the age of social media, and even my, like, I grew up, you know, in this like analog kind of pre-social media. And so I would just digest these movies, not knowing any of the box office, not knowing any of the, sometimes not knowing any of these people. I was just going to enjoy it. And so I like looking back at these movies from 20 years ago and knowing like, oh, my experience, like I was just a kid watching a videotape or like happened to go to the movie, you know, like it's so
innocent.
Innocent pure. And nice. Yeah. Instead of like, you know, nowadays it's just so like, oh, you didn't watch this and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like so like, it's so negative. Yeah. It's like negative around like a pure movie going experience that I love. And so it's kind of taken away from some of the movies that come out that are similar to A Knight's Tale in 2021, where it's like, yes, they're not going to go on to win the Academy Award. They're not even going to be awards worthy. We don't even need to like judge them on that scale. Yeah. You can just enjoy them and have a good time for a few hours. And yeah, maybe it won't stay with you. Maybe you'll be like, oh, okay, that was okay, but that's okay too. And so I feel like this kind of brought me back watching A Knight's Tale to be like, that was fun, you know. And it wasn't like I needed to be the greatest thing ever made, you know. And sometimes I think we forget in maybe the social media, film, Twitter, or just like in a world, like you want everything to be so, I don't know, a certain level. But I kind of miss where it was just like these movies would come out in between all the other movies, you know, and that's okay too.
My issue with the movie is not that I wanted it to be the greatest movie of all time. It's that I didn't understand how with the cast that you have here, who I agree, they're all really working really hard.
Mm-hmm.
The material they're working with is rudimentary, but that's fine. The rudimentariness of the story didn't bother me, right? It's Sword in the Stone, right? It's the pauper who becomes a prince sort of a thing, right? It's Cinderella, right? It's the person who is most deserving of clout, of social status, because of the content of their character, has to sort of fake it till they make it, and then, you know, through the power of magic and or some twist of fate, you know, they either turn out to have been royalty the whole time or they're elevated to that position. I mean, Aladdin does it. Like, it's an old story trope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it works, right? It works. It appeals to all of us, that all of us feel downtrodden at some point or left out or not in the right social group or not in the right clique or not in the, you know, not of the upper echelon of whatever it is, right? Film Twitter or film criticism or podcast or at work or with our friends. We all have insecurities.
Yeah.
And
We want a Prince Edward to come and
We want a fairy godmother to come and be like, you're special, right? Like, everybody wants that. So you're exactly right. That's in this movie it's Prince Edward, but in Cinderella it's a fairy godmother or a genie or whoever, right?
Do you think maybe that's why we can look past, maybe like you said, some of your issues with the structure and also some things don't make sense, you know, and it's kind of very
My biggest issue here, Kat, with the little is bow. We don't know anything about William until the last 20 minutes of the movie. Yes. And it's so strange, because I would have cared so much more had you just given me, you know, instead of the weird cold open that we have where they're faking their way into this tournament. And if they had just given me like, okay, here's this kid. This kid is the son of a Thatcher, literally. He's William Thatcher because, you know, his dad thatched nets. You know, his dad is poor, or at least working class, and is like, you know, is obsessed with knights, and his boy's obsessed with knights and lords and ladies and royalty and whatnot. And so he's like, okay, you know, I'm going to offer you as a squire to this knight, Sir Ector, so that he can give you a better life. Because he's going to give you the life I can't, so that you can change your stars, sort of a thing. Then he sees an opportunity to, you know, impersonate Sir Ector. Then we have a motivation for him. And then if at that tournament he just happens to have a meet cute with Shannon Sostrom's, I don't even, Jocelyn. But she thinks he's a lord. She thinks he's a knight, and he's not. And now he has to keep the ruse going so that he can, A, better his stars and, you know, stay around this woman. And if the one part that didn't make any sense to me is the first tournament just so happens to be in her town, where she's like the lady of that area, right? It's in her realm. They travel to like Paris and to this place and that place. And she's for some reason just like, a groupie for jousting? Yeah. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, she has nothing else to do. That's why, I mean, he kind of addresses that. Like, you're just a silly girl. It's like, you have nothing else to do.
Well, okay, so here's my question. Okay, let's get to that, right? So you know, in a typical rom-com, right, the structure is you have the meet cute, but there's some sort of obstacle between the couple being together, right? And then there's flirtations, and then there's usually a setback. They either date, or they start dating, or they're about to date, and then there's a setback, and then they both, one or both, realize the error of their ways. They may or may not run to an airport, and they meet up again, and they fall back in love, or confess each other's love, you know, for each other, and they forget the past, and they live happily ever after. Okay, I don't have any problem with that. It's cliche, but it works. It's the structure of a rom-com, which is kind of in this movie. But when he has that scene where out of nowhere, he just starts yelling at her like, you're just a silly girl and flowers are worthless. And I didn't understand where that came from. Where was his upset coming from? And then cut to the next scene where he's writing her these opining letters, which are really, he's like Cyrano de Bergerac. He's just taking other people's feelings and putting them in a letter to this woman he loves. I didn't know where that came from. Like, it's a very jarring thing. If they had the meet cute, they're star-crossed lovers, and then he has to go on this world tour of jousting until he gets to the world championships, and she is there at the end, that him mailing her these letters and their longing for each other would have been that much more worthwhile. And when they finally meet back up, and then he's exposed as not being a knight, but she accepts him as he is, and all of that would have paid off so much more with some basic tweaks to the structure of the story. Instead, she's just following him around on his adventures. We're watching joust after joust after joust. Rufus Sewell shows up, then he disappears for a while, then he comes
like
back
going off to war and then coming, but really cares about this jousting tournament,
right? Yeah. And then that doesn't mean he's literally on the battlefield getting the results of the jousting tournament. He's like, Sir Ulrich, sorry.
But like there's people who could, like, he could die in war, but like that, this, Oh my god, yeah. It's, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, this movie, like, it doesn't really make sense. The yelling part didn't really, it was a little jarring, but
where does it come from? Why is he upset with her? Can you answer that question?
He's not upset with her, and I think this, and this is maybe reading too much into the thought process behind this, so I'm just trying to, I'm giving maybe the writer too much credit, but, like, haven't you ever gotten upset and then, like, you know, you take it out on whoever's like in, like, near you, whether that's your partner, your friend, and it's not about you. You just feel like, oh, there's so much more to this than, yeah, like, this stupid thing, you know? And she's like, obviously she has, well, like you said, she's going from tournament to tournament. Like, she really has nothing else to do. So, you know, just be like a royal. And, so she's like, you know, very happy go lucky, and like she's falling in love with this guy, and then he like has real the circumstances are real, and then I there was something that happened before that, like I think he had fallen off, or I don't know, something like had happened where it was gonna like kind of put things in jeopardy. So I think he was feeling the weight of that, like oh, there's like yes, I like this girl, but like I have other stuff, I have these people who are with me, and like, you know, I think he was just kind of the weight of all that. And so the stuff that he took out on her was not her, because of her. It was just like, oh, like I can't just be with you. Like, you know, I wish I could just be falling in love with you and go and play with silly flowers. But yeah, I have more important things than this, you know? And I think he unfortunately took it out on her, in the wrong way. But to me, it felt real, because I've had those moments where, you know, you get upset and then you take it on the wrong person. And it's not about them, it's about you. And then you have to, you know, apologize or get beat up by a jousting to prove your love.
Right. You have to be jousted near to death to get an apology out of you. You're right.
Yeah, then they'll know it's real. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. Like, I think maybe a lot of those little tweaks would have made the story and the movie way, like, it would have been a real good, like strong, like holding up, right? Like in this, and it would have been like maybe more of a cult classic. But I don't know. I just,
well, when he goes back to the dad, when he goes back, yeah, home, he goes to Cheapsides and he sees his dad, and his dad is now blind. That moment would have been so much more impactful had we had the exposition of him as a little boy, which was, speaking of like perfect casting, they found a little boy who looked just like a little, yes, Heath Ledger. Like,
yeah, and had the little, like, he had charisma as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that would have, like, but we don't see that until 2 seconds before he's reunited with his dad. And so if we had been introduced to the dad and then we don't see him for most of the movie, then by the time he makes his journey back home to his father, we kind of would have forgotten about it. And then we would have gone, oh, this is where he's from. And then when he finally meets his dad and he could finally show his dad in the arena, which was like his favorite pastime with his dad, that I am a knight. I am Sir Ulrich von Liechtenstein, and I'm going to joust, and I'm the world's greatest jouster, and all this sort of stuff. But the tragedy that his dad is blind, and he won't be able to see that his son finally made good, that would have been so much more impactful to me if they had taken the scenes that they clearly shot and they clearly wrote and just put them in the beginning of the movie. And that,
yeah,
that's the weirdest part. I don't have a problem with the cliche nature of the movie. I don't have a problem even with the sort of subpar writing. Although I don't find the movie very funny. I find it mildly charming at times, but not as charming as it ought to be with the amount of talent you have.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the way the movie was edited, I think the way that they chose to structure the scenes actually hurts the overall charm of the movie and keeps me from being as invested as I ought to be. I don't mind a story old as time. I didn't laugh. I didn't cry. I felt nothing. But it all came down to structure, because when we got to that last 30 minutes or so, I was like, why wasn't this dispersed throughout the rest of the movie? I don't know anything about Will. Nothing. I have no idea what motivates him.
Yeah, maybe the only thing I'm thinking is they really, while they didn't follow a lot of, like you said, the structure, they really chose to hold those flashbacks when he gets knocked out. And also, like, when Rufus gets knocked out at the end, or Count Adhemar or whatever, he goes through his own little, like, flashback or, like, you know,
vision
kind of daze moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they really held to that. They didn't just put, like, you know, like you were saying, like they could have put the flashback for us in the beginning and then they would have been, yeah, we would have known what was going on. And I feel like they, for some reason, they chose to only do those flashbacks when he's like getting knocked out.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can think is that they, maybe it kind of goes in line with the whole story, the theme of, you know, hiding who you are. And so like, it's hiding who he is from us as well, from the audience, you know, because that was like a big thing with the Prince Edward, and ultimately what saves him, you know, is they're both going through that same thing of trying to be somebody else, but eventually it comes out. So that's the only thing that maybe the writer, you know, maybe the writer was trying to do is like, oh, we're going to keep the audience also, you know, hidden from William's secret, because that's what he's doing. And when you try to run away from your past, you don't want to think about it. You know, it's only in those moments where like it really does come in, like literally hit you over the head, that you have to, and you're forced to think about it. So maybe it's like a little bit of stretch because you have to really think about it. Like, I'm barely thinking about this, but that's the only thing I can think where, you know, they chose to do it in those moments and reveal it late, because, you know, that's how the other people are getting that info as well, you know, and like maybe it's just like an audience thing. Like, he was trying to hide who he was, even from you. But movie wise, though, doesn't, you know, like you said, those, if they did it in the beginning, it would have made sense. But if they're trying to go with the theme and be, you know, maybe try to be more like smart about it, that's the only thing I can justify maybe of like why they did that.
Well, you're obviously, I think, doing more work than the writer and director, yes, Brian Helgeland did for this movie. And I, here's what I'll say. I can forgive a lot of bullshit in a movie.
Yeah, me too.
Especially if it's a rom-com, if I find the central like love interest or love story compelling, right? Like, there's rom-coms are full of bullshit. What do you think about this love affair between William Thatcher and Jocelyn, aka Heath Ledger and Shannon Sossaman? Do you feel like they have chemistry? Do you feel like that works? Do you believe in their love story? Did it work for you? Did it move you? Were you able to suspend your disbelief with some of the maybe lesser writing or structural choices in the film because of the central romance of the film?
I wouldn't say it goes down in my books of like that, what you just asked me. I don't know if they're really, it feels like they're just reading the lines and they don't have that great of a chemistry.
No.
And I have to say, and while I'm justifying some of these story arc, I mean, I'm not really like, like I said, I'm kind of in the middle with this movie. It's fun. If it comes on, maybe I'll watch some of it. You know, I think it's one of those things, right? Like, if I'm trying to look back and also recommend it to people, like, it's not going to blow you away, but it's not going to also make you hate your, like, why did I spend 2 hours doing it, right?
Right.
But I think overall, what I came out after watching this movie, looking back at like Heath Ledger and stuff, is like, it just made me a little bit sad, because the one thing that maybe kept me going through this movie, is the ensemble. Like, I love Paul Bettany and Mark Addy and Alan Tudyk and Heath Ledger. And you just see how, like, and I didn't see it back then because I didn't, you know, I don't know who Heath Ledger was, you know, like, it was kind of like barely coming out. But seeing it like, I guess now that I'm older and like can appreciate a little bit more of like the acting, like, he was a leading man. And it's like at the very end, like, you know, he's playing kind of like a cute, like, kind of, I don't know, like, throughout the whole movie, right? But at the very end, he like turns it on when he like jousts like Rufus's character, and like he puts on like kind of like the patriot-ish,
yes,
role.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I love. I watched that movie like a million times. But so it just showed like, oh yeah, I'm watching this movie and I'm so invested, because like you said, all those elements are there, like, eh, it's kind of meh. But he's the one that was the most compelling character, and I fell in love with him more so than like any of the other relationships, I think.
It could have just been his story without a romance. I realize like that goes.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, yeah, that you brought, yeah, it up, you're like, yeah, I really didn't care for a romance. And I think that was just, they always throw in the romance,
yep,
because they think that we need it. And sometimes it's, I cared about his journey. Like, you know, he was not running from his past, but, you know, obviously he had to go and do, like, he wanted to become a knight. His dad loved him so much to do, like, the love of the dad.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the heart of the movie is him and the father. And it almost feels like they shot that or they made that. Here's what it feels like to me. It feels like this is really about, like, this is a father-son movie.
Mm-hmm. And then some executive was like, no, we need a love story
Bingo.
In there.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, and maybe that was a part of it. Maybe the love story was a part. But I think some of the structural issues, I think, come down to it feels like it was edited oddly. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels like somebody meddled with it. And I don't have any proof of that, but it feels meddled with to accentuate the romance and downgrade the father storyline when it seems like the heart of the movie at some point was really the father storyline, and the Jocelyn romance was just a B plot or a C plot in the movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like they flipped that, where they made the romance the A plot, but it's really not about him and this woman. It's really about him changing his stars, right? It's really about him elevating himself and honoring his father. And you know, the movie, the climax of the movie is not like, it's this weird CGI kiss in front of a blue screen between the two of them. But the real climax of the movie is him, or the real resolution of the movie is him screaming his own name, which is kind of dumb. It's a little patriot. It's a little Braveheart, but whatever. It's him screaming William as he overthrows the classist, Count Adamair or whatever his name is. And you know, it's about the poor rising up, and it's about the sword in the stone, right? King Arthur, right? It's chance, fate, or in the case of this movie, making your own fate, right? Making your own way in the world and not letting institutional structures hold you down, and taking opportunities to make your own legacy and to define yourself and define your own identity. That's the heart of the movie. And that has been chopped down to fill in with this Shannon Sossaman. No offense to her, but she has zero charisma in this movie. Yeah. Zero. Zero. You're exactly right. There just feels like they're just reading lines at each other. And it just feels so tacked on in a way and emphasized poorly. That it's just like, that's not the heart of the movie. The heart of the movie is this guy making his way in the world with his friends, this screwball ensemble trying to, do the impossible. It's Rocky, right? It's an underdog story. That's all it is.
And I loved, the best part was when Watt, played by Alan Tudyk, I think that you're right about maybe it is added on later, or they tried to maybe that's why and I feel like that's a good inkling. I wish we could confirm that.
Yeah.
But when he says at the end, when he's about to joust Adamar or whatever, and he's like, hey, your dad just heard, Sir William Thatcher, that it even brings a little, a little water to my eyes, because I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. But I mentioned before, I did kind of tear up in this movie, and it was during the times with his dad.
Yes.
It wasn't any of the romance stuff.
Here's my guess, Kat. Here's my guess is that they shot the ending, and the ending is all about the dad.
Mm-hmm.
And a studio executive said, we got all this stuff with the girl in here. Emphasize that, because he's also coming off of, a teen rom-com. And he's positioned as a teen heartthrob.
Yes. They wanted to keep that going into the movie. Mm-hmm.
And so, but we have a problem, because the climax is not really about her. It's really about him and his dad.
Yeah.
So what do we do with all this stuff that we shot about the dad? Well, you got to put it in there somewhere, because you have to explain at some point to the audience why that matters. Well, you just put in a third act. I think that stuff was originally shot the when he was a little boy. I think that was supposed to be earlier in the movie, and then somebody reshuffled it towards the end.
Yeah.
Because unless they completely reshot the ending, there was no way around it. You had to introduce the dad character at some point. And so I think that it just feels that way. It feels like it was futzed with a little bit. And maybe it was on the script level, maybe it was in the edit, maybe it was, I don't know, but at some point it definitely feels like, well, Heath Ledger's a teen heartthrob, this is a teen girl movie, so, that we needed this to be a teen girl movie, as if teen girls couldn't relate to an underdog story, like as if teen girls can have nothing in their life but romance, like that. But that's a very 2001 mentality.
Yeah, like look at me. Like I was connected to the father son story, and I didn't care for like the romance. It's just, I think it's a very archaic way of looking at what audiences wanted, right, and what you thought you wanted. But now, like the stronger story was the father son relationship that anyone could, because I could look at, you know, relate it to my mom and daughter, or me and my dad, you know, that sort of thing, and wanting to make them proud. And so
it's a little known fact, Kat. It's a little known fact. Women have fathers too.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, I was like reminded, like, oh, I have a dad.
But that's the thing.
And like, let's circle back on that.
How many movies are about father-daughter relationships?
Yeah, I don't know. And they do it in such a weird way. And I will say, my dad was the one, like, he was the one taking me to school and, like, you know, cooking me breakfast. And also, he was the one putting, like, because I was, like, a straight-A student.
There you go.
But he would put the bumper stickers, you know? So it's, like, this is sort of, like, you know, my daughter got straight-A's in 6 weeks or whatever.
Right, right.
And so it's, like, so funny because, yeah, maybe that's why I relate to that, is, like, you remember those moments. And so whoever decided that, women or girls couldn't relate to the father-son story is silly.
It's very silly. It's very, very silly.
Because it's universal. You just insert whatever your experience is with whoever has made, you know, like your grandma, whatever. And it's like, yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, I really like, it just makes, maybe this is a good, I'm not for putting this out there for reboots and stuff, but if anyone did want to do this, because obviously it's Heath Ledger, so it'd also be kind of like, don't like, do him dirty. But there is potential for a different kind of story here.
That's the weirdest part about this movie is casting, other than I think Shannon Sossaman. The casting, spot on. You have all this charisma. Paul, you know, I do find it odd that Paul Bettany was like, oh, is these smarmy guys, and then when Marvel finally get him, they cast him as the one character that has zero personality.
I remember, this movie, actually watching it again, I was like, oh yeah, Paul Bettany was really, like, because he was also in the Smart movie. What's the one that he with his wife, Russell Crowe, A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah, right.
He was like, he was like the imaginary friend. And like, I remember him being kind of like, ooh, like not like bordering creepy, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it's like, he has like lost all of that. He with I mean, I don't want him to be creepy, but like what you described is like, he had personality. And this one made me like, oh, I remember Paul Bettany in that way.
Yeah, he was like, he's in Faded. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He's in A Beautiful Mind. He's in, he was like a villain in that really weird cybersecurity Harrison Ford movie. What was it called? Firewall or something like that. He was in that terrible Legion movie, right? With the gosh. But then he's done basically nothing but Marvel shit since then. And nothing, it's like nothing monotone. Against it, nothing against Marvel or whatever, but like the guy has some like weird, creepy, villainy charm or smarm to him, to the point that he trolled all of the WandaVision fans real hard. It's just odd that like, okay, you're going to be the character who has no personality.
But you built your career on that.
Yeah. And that's what you're going to, but you know what? He's taking it to the bank, man. He's working.
Oh yeah. I would. Yeah, it's probably just, I mean, not easy, but it's like, yeah. But this kind of made me remember like the old Paul Bettany, and I hope so. So I think like, especially for people who only, you know, like the people we talked about who were born in 2001 and beyond, which still blows my mind, that are now 20 years old and maybe discovering this film for the first time, they're probably, you know, this was like, I saw Paul Bettany before the Marvel stuff. And so this might kind of like be very odd to them. So if anything, I would recommend people who haven't seen this, just because you see the early, like, you know, you do see like Rufus, who obviously goes on to do the same sort of roles, but Mark Addy and Alan Tudyk and, you know, late Heath Ledger. But yeah, it's just, you see the star quality in all of them. And it really reminds you like, oh, people do have that like it factor. Or you don't, you know, like Shannon Sossaman, she's fine and everything, but she didn't, I think that's why she didn't go on to be like whatever. It's just kind of like, okay, you know.
I wanted this movie to be more fun than it was. I want it to be more funnier and more charming and more engaging. And I think the other thing that hurts it is the direction's kind of flat. You know, other than an odd scene here or there, it's just sort of like he just sort of sets the camera and things happen and then next shot, next shot. It needs some verve, it needs some life to it, and the movie just sort of feels, it does its cast a disservice, unfortunately. Yeah. That's my takeaway. So as we bring this conversation to a close, now that you've had 20 years to be able to look back, now that you've been able to have hindsight, which is 2020, what is your retrospective on A Knight's Tale? How would you sum it up? And would you recommend it to our folks listening at home?
Yeah, I as much as we dissected it, and you know, there now I see that it does make sense about the you know, father son story that I connected more with, and the friendship part in this movie. But looking back, I think I enjoyed it more this time. And I don't know why that is. Maybe I just was really going with, like, also the Heath Ledger perspective of, you know, obviously he hadn't passed when I watched this originally. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe some of that is the nostalgic factor of, like, what could have been. But I have to say, I would recommend it. I think it's a nice movie. Maybe also some movie that you can put on while you're crafting or something like that, you know, and then you'll kind of come back in when you know, Heath Ledger's on screen and, like, reels you in, because he has so much charisma and he's just so, he did have that leading man quality, which is, makes me just so sad to know that he's, you know, what he could have been doing in, like, his 40s, you know, like, it would have been so good. And then also the other cat, like Paul Bettany, I would recommend, just because you're going to see him, like, butt naked in this, like, it's just so odd, you know. And then Mark Addy, who's always really good, and, you know, and also Rufus, who, you know, stereotypical handsome villain role. And then also some of the side characters who I hadn't even really looked up, but I looked up when I was researching for this, but like Laura Fraser, who played Kate, and also I don't know how to say her name because there's a lot of accents in there, so sorry, but Berenice Bejo, who's actually Argentinian, so that was kind of cool to see her in this, which is like, also, how is there like an Argentinian in this? Like, so I kind of appreciated, like, they didn't really care for that, and they had, like, you know, there is like this sort of, the women characters in this, they weren't just, you know, subservient, you know, they were strong. And so, like, in 2001, I will give him credit for that, at least the director and writer.
As you can tell, I'm a little bit more down on the movie than you are. Mm-hmm. Just because I think in retrospect, we can look back and look at this cast and go, God damn, what a cast of people in this movie. And it's kind of odd to say, but if they had just followed a more tropey...
Sometimes that's why they have that, right?
Yeah, yeah. If they had just followed, a more cliche structure, I think the movie would have been more effective. You're mm-hmm. sort of, you said, it's okay, but you're it's okay leaning towards the positive, and I would say it's okay, but leaning towards the negative. I think it's more than anything, I think it's a curio, it's a curiosity mm-hmm. piece for yes. younger generations and for film fans of, like, why doesn't this work that well? Because it should. On yeah. paper, it should. Mm-hmm. You know, we never even touched upon the anachronistic music, but there's really yeah. nothing to say about it because it serves no thematic purpose. It's just in there. Why? Nobody knows.
I'm so in neutral, like, in a way, like, it doesn't make you feel much in some of those stylistic choices, you know, and maybe that's a negative, because it's just like, yeah, just like the Jocelyn character in Shannon's Awesome Air. I'm just like, meh.
Right. It's not bad. Like, it's not like, oh, but it's just yeah. sort of like, okay.
But forgettable sometimes is not good, you know? Yeah. It's like, yeah. except for the everything that we mentioned that are not forgettable. But like a lot of this is just like, you're going to not really think about it after you watch it.
Kat, where can people find you if they want to say you're wrong about A Knight's Tale, or you're right about A Knight's Tale, or if Shannon Sossaman wants to drag you online, where can she where can she at you?
So I'm gonna give a fake number. please, it's no dig to you, Shannon. It's just this role, okay? You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Things Kat Loves, and that's with the C-A-T.
Thank you for doing this. I wish that the middling film of 2001 we would suddenly uncover as, like, with retrospective, yes. it's just a gem. But it's just kind of still middling, I think. And
yeah.
But I will say this. I agree with you that sometimes middling films, that's fine. It's all it needs to be. It's, you need a movie to craft to, like you said, and you need movies to fold your laundry to. So
yes.
TNT yeah. needs movies too. So
yes, yes. Sometimes it's okay. It's okay, guys. Just put it on while you're doing something else.
Yeah. Put on your mediocre movie, cry a tear, be mocked by your husband, move on with your life. All right, Kat.
That's a synopsis.
Yep. We will catch you down the road. We're excited to see what you got coming up in the future and see where things are headed for you. Big things ahead, I think. So it's always an honor to have you on, and we hope to talk to you in the future. And until next time, binge on.
They say laughter is the best medicine, especially when it's your first day as a doctor.
What's going on down there?
Nothing, ma'am. This is totally normal.
Scrubs, NBC Tuesdays this fall after Frasier.